Welcome to Women at War, a feminist podcast. My name is Dilar Dirik. I'm a political sociologist, currently working at the University of Oxford, and I'm the host of this podcast, which has been made possible through funding from the University of Oxford's Public Engagement with Research Fund. In this introduction episode, I want to tell you about the philosophy behind this podcast. Several of the episodes have mentions and in some cases graphic descriptions of rape, sexual violence, harassment, femicide, violence against queer people, racism, slavery, genocide, and settler colonial violence. These topics come up throughout the episodes, and I encourage you to skip these episodes if this is something that you need to do at this point. Let me start out by saying that this podcast is not detached from current political events and developments. In fact, recent events such as the 2021 handover of Afghanistan to the Taliban or the Turkish state's military operations in three parts of Kurdistan over the last years were among the events that sparked the idea to launch this project. That's because these and other experiences discussed in the six main episodes of this podcast illustrate why it is crucial to view gender as a central rather than a secondary question in our understanding of political violence. It is widely recognized that women are disproportionately vulnerable in contexts of war and forced displacement. Images of women from the regions covered in the episodes of this podcast are highly visible in media accounts. Yet, knowledge production on political conflict, from media to academia, often treats the dimension of gender as a side issue. What is more, women's resistances against different forms of violence, from so-called domestic abuse to militarism and large-scale state violence, often goes unrecognized. In fact, sometimes it is stigmatized. In my research, which among other things focuses on women's autonomy and resistance in the context of violence and forced displacement in the Middle East region, I'm particularly keen on understanding women's quest for justice in the aftermath of episodes of large-scale political violence, in particular state violence. While doing this research, I often come across fascinating works written by women who produce knowledge for a world without violence. Sadly, much of this work is kept behind institutional walls. Most people don't have access to the knowledge produced in academia. People need institutional affiliation to even browse some very important works. But this is not the only barrier. Often, academic language, including feminist theory, is highly inaccessible. It is difficult to understand, and as many people would agree, it's unnecessarily so. Like many others, I believe that knowledge must be free and accessible to everyone, without gates, barriers, or borders. So today, unprecedented amounts of funding are allocated to gender issues in the world of conflict and security. It's important to recognize this development. However, as feminists have pointed out for decades, gender, as I mentioned earlier, is not something to also consider during times of war and conflict. In fact, since ancient times, gender has been a primary organizing principle of state, militarism, occupation, and political violence. As argued by Kathy Gaka, for example, who was a classic scholar with expertise on sexual violence and war in the ancient world, I quote here, "The predominant conception of warfare as a matter of man-to-man violence must be transformed from the ground up," end quote. So while recognizing this, we should also be careful not to suggest that violence against women is natural or normal. It is not a fact of life. It is an outcome of mentalities and social structures and power and domination-based systems based in material conditions. And we will talk more about that in the different episodes. Any system, even those that have come into being over periods of thousands of years, such as patriarchy, can also be changed, dismantled, and abolished. So understanding how patriarchy works means taking a look at other large-scale systems or historical periods as well, such as capitalism, colonialism, and the state. So, Women and War is a platform to learn about women's experiences with war, violence, occupation, colonization, and forced displacement, but also about their collective struggles for liberation, justice, and peace. The invited guests, who are engaged critical feminist academics and activists, speak about legacies of genocide, femicide, occupation, and invasion, in the context of places like Armenia, Afghanistan, Kurdistan, Palestine, Pakistan, and beyond. In addition to providing background and sharing knowledge, The guests reflect on their own scholarship as well. They discuss contemporary knowledge production on women's resistance. And together, we counter Orientalist and patriarchal narratives and instead center women's practices of resistance and collective struggle, past and present. The podcast also, this is important to say, treats gender as a central organizing principle that manifests in a variety of ways within different forms of violence. What does that mean? It means doing the opposite of what is often done, which is to treat gender as a side issue, as a side effect, as something to consider afterwards. So what we will do is to view gender as a central aspect. So the podcast also aims to amplify the diversity of experiences in the region. This is important to note because the experiences of women in different parts of the region, but also beyond, are of course in many ways similar, but they're also different in crucial ways. So while offering historical context to contemporary wars and conflicts in the region, Women in War seeks to be a space also to build transnational feminist solidarity through developing analysis together. So let's zoom out for a moment. In different parts of the world, during war, genocide, and ethnic cleansing campaigns, women have often been specifically and systematically targeted because they are women. This involves sexual violence, abduction, cultural assimilation, for example, forced marriage, as well as interventions in women's reproductive cycles through, among other things, forced abortions, forced maternity. And often, as has been argued, this can serve as what is often called a weapon of war. The case of comfort women, so-called comfort women, who were systematically enslaved and coerced into prostitution under Imperial Japan in the 1930s and 1940s, is one of many examples. Within and outside systematic annihilation plans like genocide, perpetrators also often take opportunistic advantage of environments of impunity in conflicts to rape or assault. So they take advantage of these moments of chaos in order to engage in these acts against women. At the same time, women who are seen as polluted by the enemy through rape frequently become targets of violence in their own communities. Often, women who are victims of sexual violence are murdered by their own families or partners in the name of family honor or national honor. So in this sense, we can say that violence against women is very often a structure in war, genocide, and occupation. So much so that even when women physically survive, their health, including their mental health, their social relations, and their sense of self may not survive. And that's why it's important to consider feminicide or femicide also as something beyond the mere physical killing of women. Studying the world of women and war allows us then to see how deeply violence ruptures community relations and controls populations, because it intervenes simultaneously in the realm of the intimate and the public, realms which are often treated as separate from each other. Latin American feminist scholar Rita Segato argues that, I quote here, that the distinction between intimate femicides and public warlike femicides, end quote, is indefensible, especially in colonial and racialized contexts, as seen in the murders on indigenous and farmer communities in Guatemala, for example. There, under the guise of anti-communist counterinsurgency against the guerrillas in Guatemala, CIA-sponsored soldiers engaged in systematic rape and murders of Mayan women to destroy communal relations through regimes of terror, forced displacement, and dispossession. One similarity between victims of state, parastate, and intimate femicide is then the spectacular display of corpses, often charged with symbolic meaning. As Rita Segato argues, the symbolic power of sexual violence and its codes are legible, understandable in a near universal manner, a lingua franca, a universal language of patriarchy. So war, genocide, and occupation therefore rely on gendered violence as the physical and symbolic degradation, capture, and submission of women, and through them, all of society. In both war and peace, social and physical femicide controls and disciplines society through violence, And here again, I want to point out that it was above all Latin American feminists who have been at the forefront of pointing to the critical role of the state in cycles of violence against women. This podcast also is very keen on taking a historical approach to things due to some of the reasons that I have already outlined. Let's take a look at one very recent example of horrifying large-scale violence against women in the Middle East, the genocide on the Yazidi people in Shingal, or Sinjar, in 2014 by the so-called Islamic State, a group that systematically used sexual violence, especially against women from different regions, as a weapon of terror, propaganda, and also government. Thousands of men were murdered on the spot, while thousands of women and children were abducted, with many, especially young women, being trafficked into slavery. What happened in Shingal was horrifying, and yet regional historical episodes like the Armenian Genocide, which began in 1915, in many ways show that the so-called Islamic State is merely one chapter in a longer patriarchal history in the region and beyond. We can consider instances of large-scale political violence from the Armenian genocide to the ISIS genocide on the Yazidi community in 2014, both of which unfolded around the same geography, a century apart, also as episodes of systematic feminicide with lasting consequences on regional communities. So while understanding such links and similarities is crucial, one must be cautious neither to exceptionalize nor to erase these particular experiences. Here I should note that many episodes do focus on particular experiences within context. So for example, in the episode on Afghanistan, we focus especially on the Hazara women. In the episode on Kurdistan, we zoom in on Alevi women. In the episode of Pakistan, we pay particular attention to women in Balochistan. In fact, one of the aims of this podcast is to amplify the ways in which the study of women and war can help us understand the relationship and interplay between the local and the global, the universal and the particular. So one interesting theme that came up in the words of the guests is that they actively make an effort to understand topics like genocide, slavery or settler colonialism, also by learning from the experiences of women around the world, such as histories of or analysis from indigenous and black women. When speaking of women and war, it is at the same time very important, as amplified in particular in the episodes on Kurdistan and Palestine, to know that women are not simply victims or survivors of violence. Another objective of the podcast is to challenge dominant ideas that characterize women in this region in particular, but in the global south more generally, primarily through a lens of passive victimhood. We see that women can often challenge men's and state's monopoly on the use of violence and even develop forms of self-defense by participating, among other things, in revolutionary or national liberation struggles. In fact, decades before state armies began recruiting women as soldiers, women were already fighting in resistance movements. In different parts of Europe, women took part in anti-fascist resistances. In places like Algeria, Palestine, Nicaragua, South Africa, the Philippines, Colombia, India, Sri Lanka, and more, women participated in guerrilla struggles against colonization, apartheid, and occupation, and for sovereignty and national liberation. One other aim of the podcast is to take a critical look at economies of women's empowerment today. As many people may be aware, from the US invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan in the 21st century, the protection of women can often be a pretext to justify imperial militaristic agendas and to cover up war crimes. This is ironic considering the long history of Western states' support for radical Islamist groups since the time of the Cold War. More generally, feminist scholars have been arguing that top-down and security-oriented frameworks, while making use of the language of gender equality and justice, radically depart from critical feminist analyses about militarism, warfare, and violence. So the co-optation of feminist language can actually dampen knowledge production on war, as well as the resistance against it. So in several episodes, the podcast guests offer reflections on the ways in which women's resistance struggles are often co-opted, pacified, distorted, or rendered invisible by neoliberal patriarchal, Western-centric, or statist agendas. For example, through what people often call NGOization, the process of turning resistance struggles into neoliberal enterprises. This and many other topics will be covered in the 6 main episodes. I sincerely hope that the podcast will encourage people to engage directly with women's knowledge production from the region and from the global south more generally. I do hope that it can inform collective efforts towards analyzing and fighting against war, occupation, femicide, and all forms of violence and injustice. Finally, I would like to point out that sadly, while this podcast is funded by the University of Oxford's Public Engagement with Research Fund, the University of Oxford, through its departments and colleges, is actively complicit in the war and also in the border industries. So through investing or accepting money from arms manufacturing companies, unfortunately, our educational institutions in the UK are also entangled in the business of death. At the same time, student and staff campaigns are actively organizing to encourage the university to divest from the war, border, and fossil fuel industries. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, which was created in solidarity and with respect to all those struggling for a world without war. Thank you for listening. مريم يا دلي شعر بالتلي